Okay, it's May 10th, 2002, and Gordon Cameron is here with Colin Bairstow in Whitehorse, and we're interviewing Mr. Cameron, continuing interviewing Mr. Cameron about Yukon Aviation heritage and his years in Yukon Aviation. So on the previous day, you had been, I think, talking about a pilot, and you had referred to his hands and feet. And I wonder if you could talk a bit more about what that means when you talked about his hands and feet.
Well, it's an expression, because actually all you require to fly an airplane is good hands and feet. The rest of the tough part and the thinking part comes into navigation and making decisions. But you can be the smartest guy in the world. If you're sloppy with your controls, your hands and your feet, you're going to have trouble. So that's all that refers to.
So if you say somebody has good hands and feet, what are you saying?
Saying that he's a good flyer, good physically a good flyer.
Can control his aircraft.
He controls the physical control of the aircraft is good. Mm-hmm. But he might be dumb when it comes to navigation or when to go and no go and all that sort of thing.
So. And what if you say he's got no hands and feet?
He's got poor hands and feet. That means he's a sloppy pilot.
So I think last day we ended off talking about the topographic surveys that were done in the North Yukon circa 1950, mm-hmm. Which Whitehorse Flying Services supported with fixed-wing aircraft. And as I understand, you said there were two Hiller 360s that were being used to do a lot of the survey work. What did they actually do with the 360s?
Well, we'd take the Beaver in the morning, and we'd take four or five people out, or maybe a couple of trips, and put them on a lake mm-hmm. fairly close to the area which they wanted to be working. And then the helicopters would come out, and they'd pick them up from the lake and put them up on the top of the hills. Mm-hmm. Because the topographical survey had to be in the high point mm-hmm. in the area. And then they'd shoot their, whatever it was, instrument across from one flag triangle to the other, and they'd do that during the day.
So they'd do that during the day.
Yeah, and when the fellows were finished their survey for the day, the helicopter would pick them up and take them back to a lake. Or maybe during the day they might pick them up and move them to another high point or hill. But eventually, at the end of the day, the helicopter would bring the surveyors, the surveyor and a helper, bring them back down to the lake where we would land with the Beaver and pick them all up and bring them back into camp.
And where would the choppers stay?
The helicopter stayed in camp with us.
Okay, so you picked the fellows up at a lake and flew them back to camp.
Yep.
And the choppers came back empty to camp then?
Or it might,
with the pilot?
Yeah, it would have maybe one surveyor with him or something.
You wouldn't sort of leave the helicopter out in the bush
at
night or anything like that?
No.
And so the helicopters themselves were just going, they were dropping the crews at one high point and taking them to the next high point, high point. And that was the way they...
During the day.
Right.
Yep.
And what can you say about the... sort of the performance of the Hiller 360?
Well, at that time, of course, it was fine, because the only alternative was the old horse survey parties. Mm-hmm. And, of course, this would do in a season. It would take them 5 or 6 years in horse parties. So it was pretty good. The only thing was they were sort of underpowered, and they weren't really that efficient, those first Hiller 360s. And they had 178 horsepower Franklin in them, and so they weren't, you know. But at the time, as I say, there was nothing much better. So they did fine, did a good job.
Did they have sort of places where they couldn't fly, or elevations they couldn't fly to?
Well, yes, they had to. The insurance was only good for a certain altitude, and if the weather was kind of crummy, why you'd have to. Like bringing them out, I remember the one summer to bring them out from the camp at Margaret Lake. The weather was really low, and they couldn't climb up to any heights. They had to stay down below the cloud, and the insurance people were quite annoyed with this. They said that that's not a very safe operation. So they had to get special permission to bring them out through
flying
the mountains.
Because of the cloudy weather?
Because of the weather and because of the limitations on the insurance to do with the altitude of the passes and so on that they had to go through.
How much capacity did they have to carry things? How much weight and how many people?
I don't remember how much weight. They'd carry two people.
And a pilot?
No, pilot and two passengers.
Pilots and two passengers.
Yeah. And
okay. And what about reliability of the 360s?
Well, they were fairly reliable. They had a pretty good box of spares along, the normal parts that they would expect to replace. And I don't recall that we had any real tie-ups that summer for any length of time.
Were you doing maintenance on the helicopters?
No, I wasn't. I was just looking after the Beaver. Okay. They had their own engineer. They had a pilot and engineer with them.
Mm-hmm. When did you see your first helicopter?
Huh. Darned if I know. I guess maybe it... Well, I don't really know. The only one I remember particularly was when they came up on the survey. Mm-hmm. From Canting Aviation, they came up from Eastern Canada.
How did they arrive?
Flew in.
They flew in to...
Ferried them all the way from Ontario.
Right. So you would have seen them first, those 360s in...
Yeah, I think they were the first ones that came into the Yukon.
You would have seen them in Whitehorse then first?
Yeah,
or?
Yeah.
Do you remember their registrations?
No, I don't. See if the altitudes of the airplanes, of the hills you were going onto.
Because
they just wouldn't handle it.
The altitude. Okay.
High altitude.
Okay, so now I see there was a gap in the tape from the previous day for just a short period, and so I'll go back and ask you a few questions. Just for an end point, when in 1944 was it that you went south to Vancouver?
September
1944.
Yeah.
Okay. So, and looking at the operations of CPA after it changed over from British Yukon Navigation. Roughly when was it that the changeover occurred from BYN? It was the...
I think that was in December of 41.
In early 42.
The thing was actually sold.
Right.
And that same year that I came into the country. I came in March, and I think it was in December. It was.
Right. And when was the actual changeover?
Well, I think December, January.
Shortly after that, yeah. And the operations of, YSAT, CPA, what sort of things were they doing related to the war effort?
The U.S. Army engineers, the railroad company, took over the railroad, mm-hmm. What company it was, but it was an American military company that took over the ships pretty well, mm-hmm. and moved barges and equipment and so on downriver. And so they, like before when the BYN were running the White Pass, were running the railroad just before the war thing got going, they'd have maybe two trips. When a boat came into Skagway, they'd have two or three trips to get the fresh stuff over to Whitehorse and so on. Then normally they just had one trip a week, and until the next boat came in. Then when the American Army railroad engineers took over, they ran, up to 12 trips a day. They moved tonnage like you wouldn't believe.
Wow, right?
And they had a odd train rack too, but they moved a lot of tonnage.
So in terms of aircraft, what was CPA doing in that sort of 1942-44?
Well, they... they moved in some of the, like the Fairchild 71s and so on. Mm-hmm. and they put the Barclays in to use some White Horse Dawson mail run and so on. And then the main line increased from the Boeing 247 to Lockheed Lodestars.
Lodestar had more capacity than a 247?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Lockheed Lodestar carried, I think it was 18.
Right.
And Lockheed 14 before that, it carried, 14, total 14.
Yeah, and you were...
And the Boeing 247 carried 10, I think.
Ah, okay. And what was your position, sir? You started as an apprentice in 41, and now
Well, I was just, when CPA came along, I was a crew chief in maintenance.
Right. And who were the other engineers and maintenance people in that period there, 42, 44?
Well, of course, there was Don Dixon and Ken McLean, who were the engineers that were killed with Les Cook on the Norseman, and there was Tommy Acheson and Harold Davenport and Gordon Anderson and Lloyd Ryder and myself.
Who are the managers of the
when it was still the BYN company, it was Ev Wasson was the head of it all, and Harold Davenport was the chief engineer.
Right, and with CPA.
And with CPA, it was started out. Oh golly, I don't know. It was Wagner was one superintendent we had, and Windrum was another one, and Wap May for a while, and Hollick Kenyon for a while, and Ted Fields, and Russ Baker, they were all supervisory people in the first two or three years.
Shifting to other carriers, just as you were arriving, as I understand, the only other mainline carrier going through was Pan Am.
Uh-huh.
And
Then there was... just about, 42, I guess. Pollock Airlines out of Fairbanks.
How would you spell that?
Pollock, P-O-L-L-O-C-K.
Mm-hmm.
And later became Northern Consolidated, and then became Ween Alaska, and then Alaska Airlines.
And what were they doing?
They were flying. They had a sked once or twice a week, I've forgotten now, and they were using a small blanket for a while, and then they used a Stinson Reliant.
Wow.
And then they used a Vultee, low wing, retractable undercarriage, all metal. Carried about 8 or 10 people, single engine. And
and what route were they flying?
That's what Pollock was flying.
But where were they flying?
From Fairbanks to Whitehorse.
And that was their route, eh?
Yeah. And the Pan Am, of course, once they got the Navy contract, they were using DC-3s, but up until then they used a Lockheed 12 and Lockheed Lodestars.
Mm-hmm.
Lockheed 12, in fact, had a gear failure, and he had land on one wheel in the White Horse, did a good job.
And what... what color was the Navy's color scheme?
Well, they're that pale blue, bluey gray.
These were the aircraft that Pan Am were flying.
Yeah, that was the DC-3s. Their Lodestars were all silver with the Pan Am dark blue and their insignia on the side.
How could you distinguish those? The Navy colored DC-3s that Pan Am was flying. Did it say Pan Am on them, or did it just have U.S. Navy on them?
No, U.S. Navy, yeah.
Right, but... And
Pan Am had the Pan Am. And then they, I think they, shortly after that, they stopped flying the Lodestars and just stuck to the DC-3s.
Any other operators flying aircraft through that you recollect?
No scheduled operators.
Were there sort of bulges in the air traffic, the sort of transport traffic going through that you recollect?
Well, every airplane was loaded, because I remember going out on holidays and trying to come back on the airline, and they hauled a lot of military personnel too from up from Vancouver and Edmonton. I got stuck in Fort St. John for 10 days. Every airplane going through was full up.
And you went out flying what airline?
I went out on CPA.
Right.
And they are also doing the Fairbanks run from Whitehorse to Fairbanks, and they hauled a lot of military personnel in that. And I flew on that as a flight engineer for a while. Put in long days. Some days we'd do two trips up and back. They're long days.
Two trips up and back from
Whitehorse to Fairbanks.
Wow, one-way travel time would be about
2.5 hours.
Right.
It was about 5-6 hours return.
Any particular?
We had to service the airplane at the other end too.
Servicing and being.
Well, gassing, oiling.
Right. And any other particular difficulties you remember in those legs to Fairbanks?
No. Well, you had to be very careful and make sure you had the code of the day before you went on a trip, because if you didn't have the code, you couldn't get the weather reports and any other information that they wanted to pass on to you. And sometimes you'd look out the airplane and you'd see a fighter, American fighter, off your wingtip or something, making sure you didn't deviate from the control area. And then a lot of the time they made you pull the blinds so you weren't looking out when they were going into Fairbanks, because it was a military base.
Where did you get your code of the day?
From the weather office before you left.
Oh.
You got it, and they'd give you the code of the day to get the weather and so on.
Whose responsibility was that to get that?
The pilot.
The
pilot, yeah.
Do you remember what they were? Were they a series of digits or alpha digits?
No, in fact, I can't remember. I never paid any attention to them anyway. It was just the pilot that was stuck with them. But we didn't have one. One time I was coming out of Watson Lake with this with the pilot, and he didn't have the code of the day, and we ran into weather, and we had a devil of a time. We couldn't get a hold of anybody. But we staggered through. But
so what did the code of the day, what would you do with that? Do you know what the pilot would do with that? Once
well, you'd have to repeat it. You'd repeat it for, if you were calling in by radio, you'd tell them what the code was of the day, and then they'd give you the information, whatever it was.
So on this one occasion, you're coming out of Watson. Of you couldn't make radio contact, or you could, but you didn't have the code.
Nobody would give us any information.
So you didn't bother trying.
No.
Do you remember who the pilot was that day?
Harvey Johnson.
Harvey Johnson.
Yeah.
And you don't remember if it was like just a series of numbers, or like whiskey is the code today, or
no,
blackjack?
No, I can't recall what it was. Yeah. As I say, I never paid any attention to them anyway.
Or what year would that have been?
That was 1942, 43.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember any people discussing the difficulty in getting weather information when they were flying?
No, I can't think of any now.
So you mentioned American fighters off your wingtips. Now, where would that have been?
Going into Fairbanks.
So that was not sort of flying through the, would that also have been flying through the Yukon stretch?
Or? No.
Fairbanks, what kind of fighters?
Oh, usually it was a B-25 or a
B-25 would be a bomber.
Yeah, a bomber type, or P-40.
Right.
And they just come in when you're into the control zone. Call you in, make sure you bid the right turn at the right time.
You mentioned pulling the blinds.
Yeah.
You would be, of course, engineer, so you would be riding in a jump seat or something back in the cabin?
No, I was in the cabin, but the stewardess ground pulled the blinds down.
Right. And do you remember how strict they were about that?
Well, they were fairly strict. I never heard of any particular fighting over it, but.
What about taking photographs on the grounds at Whitehorse. Were there any restrictions there that you remember?
Not that I remember, no.
I don't know of any. If you happen to have your Brownie out, your camera out one day, or your Kodak at the building,
you take pictures.
As you wish.
But I know, like on the highway, there was a control gate at McRae and a control gate just up by the Copper King. So that to go north or south beyond those control points, you had to have a permit from the RCMP. And these were armed guards that were on there. They had a gate. They'd open up and let you through.
McRae and one end.
McRae.
And the other end was?
The Copper King.
Copper King.
The rest of it, yeah.
And so you could have free passage within the bounds of
Within. But we used to go, and like we quite often go to Annie Lake fishing and so on. Well, you had to get a permit to get through to Carcross Road and across to Annie Lake.
Annie Lake, okay. And so there were there no back roads that people would tend to use to skirt those boundaries? Or
no.
No, that's a mistake.
No, there was no way around them.
This is a story on CPA buying out.
On CPA buying out. You see, this, the CPR, they had the ships, mm-hmm. and they were losing ships that were being sunk during the war, and they couldn't replace them. They couldn't buy new ships. So they used this money to get into the airplane business. Mm-hmm. Now, how true that is, I don't know. It makes sense, all right. Sounds logical.
Mm-hmm. And as far as you recollect, at the time in late 1941, early 1942, when in name, Yukon Southern buying out British Yukon Navigation. People, did they understand what was going on between Yukon Southern and CPA?
I don't know whether they did or not. I think we who worked for the company, we sort of knew what was happening, and but I don't think the man in the street probably gave it any thought at all.
Sorry, you were saying you had to fly flight engineer?
On the Dawson Mayo run with the DC-3s. Well, actually, with the Barclays, I flew in the right-hand seat. As I think I mentioned to you, they couldn't find pilots in those days, so one of us grease monkeys would fly in the co-pilot seat, and then when they got the Lodestars, they had to have two qualified pilots, and so you'd ride, as engineer, you'd ride just in the passenger seat. Service the airplane in Mayo and Dawson, wherever you happen to land.
Did you have any? How much practical flying experience did you have by that point? And had you started to learn to fly fixed wing? Put it that way.
No, I didn't. Well, I had done a bit of it during the start of the war when I was still in school. I'd go to the airport on the weekends, and these fellows were trying to get the time in to be instructors, go to the elementary flying training school program. And so they'd looking for dummies to put in the front cockpit. And so I did a lot of that, and they pretending they were instructors and going through all of the patter they had to know. So I did, you know, a fair amount of stick time then. And then I didn't, but I didn't do any of it when I came north. It was strictly on maintenance. And it was after I left, came back from the Army and quit the airline. I went with George Milne, and we formed Whitehorse Flying Services Limited. And that's when he said, well, you probably should learn to fly, make it easier to operate. So I did. Then that would be 1940. 47, 48.
So what aircraft were you learning to fly?
Fleet Canuck,
and who was giving you instruction?
George Milne.
Okay.
He was an instructor, yeah.
And so that was the aircraft you learned to fly on. What was the call numbers? Do you remember that aircraft you learned to fly on?
DPN.
CF DPN. Lodestars that CPA had brought in, did they have those then for the duration of the war, or?
Actually, we got a couple that were uh, I think they were supposed to go to Trans-Canada Airlines, and we got them, and then they called them back in, and these had twin row Pratt & Whitney's in them, and they called them back in, and they gave us a couple of U.S. Army Lodestars. They were all camouflaged and so on, and they had big right whirlwinds in them. And we had those for the duration of the war.
Okay, so how long did you have the ones with the twin row Pratt & Whitney's?
I think it was less than a year, and they decided they were taking them back.
And how long before you got the next Lodestar?
Well, right away. They didn't. They took them back and gave us a complete exchange right at the same time.
And so they were the first ones. What paint scheme did they have on them?
All silver, and I think just the writing on the side, Canadian Pacific Airlines.
And then the loads, yeah. Sort of the second set?
The second set were all camouflaged. And they had still had CPA. They had crest on the nose. And,
mm-hmm. And you remember the call numbers of any of those aircraft? Or?
No, I don't. Got a picture of some of them, I think, in the album.
That would be your photo album.
Yeah.
So you talked before about moving several, at least, aircraft wrecks from the west side of the runway to, I believe it was a gully at the end of one of the runways. And this was in preparation for, I guess, you said construction of buildings.
Yeah.
On the west side of the runway. Where exactly was it that you moved these old aircraft to?
Well, we had the aircraft dump, which we dumped, you know, old oil cans and gas drums and bits of buildings and all sorts of junk off the south end of the airport, and it was quite a gully or a low spot just before you came to the end of the bluff, which went down into the valley, and we pulled the different wrecks of airplanes. There was an A-20, a Hudson, two Ford Trimotors, remains of Les Cook's Norseman, and I think that was about it.
So this is the south end of the original runway?
No, the, well...
I mean, it was the south end of the runway that was operating in 1941 when you arrived.
Yeah, it was just a gravel strip there. It was off the end of that, yeah.
And so if we wanted to look for sort of where the gully, or the remains of the gully, if you will, is there still a gully there that sticks in a bit from...
Built runway right over top of the thing.
Right.
So I think if you had a metal finder detector, you could find out where the stuff was, but it'd be down probably 6 or 8 feet
and
under the surface.
Is there anything left, sort of an indent even in the bank of the hill there?
No.
Yeah. And you said you used it for a dump. I mean, for oil cans and things like that, would there be waste oil and things like that?
Oh, yeah.
And that's where you'd stick
those days we never even heard of the environment.
Right, so you
never thought about it.
Could be quite a bit of waste oil. And
well, I don't know. There'd be,
something.
I would say, yeah, there'd be probably quite a bit.
And when was it that you moved that material in to the south end of the runway?
Well, that'd be in the summer of 41, I guess.
Okay, summer.
Because they started construction later that year, the first end of 41, and the beginning of 42, they brought in the scrapers and so on and started moving the... See, there was a big high rise on the far side of the airport there, and they had to remove a lot of dirt in order to get it down to reasonably level for building a runway, the building the long runway.
And they, then you continued to use this dump at the south end of that east runway, if you will. For how long?
Well, that was the end of it. Once we put that stuff in there and they brought the equipment up and started to knock down the hill and make the airport, you know, open the airport up. They level that off right away
and filled in
all the haulage on the hill.
So we were talking about the, if you will, the aircraft boneyard that you move from the west side of the airport over to the south end of the first runway that was there in 1941, and it was covered over when they moved Phil to make the second runway. Where then did you haul future wrecks to? I mean, after they started to fill in that gully and...
Well, the future aircraft wrecks were just hauled up to the cross runway, up off the end of the cross runway, and it was used for... They'd use them for fire fighting practice. Every so often, they'd throw old oil and so on them, and you'd see great clouds of black smoke from town. You knew that they were having fire practice, and then they'd go and hose them down. Like, I'm thinking of there was a B-25, I think, and the B-17 that went into Carcross,
mm-hmm.
and I forget what else.
Mm-hmm.
And they just used them to burn.
And then after they were all burnt up?
I have no idea. Took a long time because they didn't burn them up, really. You know, they'd get the fire going, then they'd put it out.
So which gulch is Puckett's Gulch?
That's the one right on the north end of the runway, first gulch you come to.
North end of which runway?
Well, either one of them ends up Puckett's Gulch, but they filled in part of it on that extension of the long runway.
Right, okay. And do you know why it's called? Any idea why it's called Puckett's Gulch?
No, well, Puckett was a guy that had a store here originally, I think, around 20s.
Right. And was there ever a road up?
Yeah, there was a road up there. It was fairly steep, but we used that certain times of the year because the short hill and the bank would slough in, or the ice would, frost would be coming out of it, and we couldn't use it. And so rather than go all the way around the 2 mile hill like they do now, we'd slip up the Puckett's Gulch.
Was the 2 mile hill there?
Yeah, it was there.
When you arrived, or the road in the 2 mile hill?
The road, yeah. And it was. One of them had the road that split and went around. You went up one side and down the other. I forget whether it was the 2 mile or Puckett's Gulch. However.
Changing again to Watson Lake, I'm wondering if you had any contact with the Winter Experimental Establishment.
No, knew it was there, but you never had anything to do with it.
So was it there before you left for the Army? Do you recollect that?
No, I think it was later on.
There when you arrived back from the Army?
I don't recall.
Did you ever go down to Watson Lake when it was operating? Did you recollect? Or
no, I don't recall.
Did any of their aircraft come to Whitehorse that you were aware of?
Not that I was aware of. There were all types of aircraft, you know, coming and going all the time. And, so you never knew whether they were involved in any sort of winter experiments or anything like that. We never were in a position. That was always done on the far side of the airport with the military establishment.
At?
Nothing came over to our side.
Do you recollect seeing military aircraft other than RCAF aircraft and U.S. Army aircraft or Air Force aircraft? Any other Air Forces aircraft?
Well, they were painted, a lot of that Lend-Lease, they were painted with the Russian Star.
Right.
And they came up, and there was once or twice that there were crews, actually, Russian crews came in to pick up the airplanes from here, but normally they picked them up from Anchorage
mm-hmm.
or Alaska.
Which aircraft was it they
mainly B P-39, Bell Air Cobras, and also a lot of DC-3s and A-20s, Douglas A-20 attacks. And those are the main ones I know of.
Did you ever see RAF aircraft in Whitehorse?
Well, after the war, there was the Comet came up a couple of times, and I don't recall any other RAF.
When did the Comet come up? Was that
that was after I was involved with the government here. The CO of the transport division of the Air Force was using it, and he came up in it, promised me a ride in it, and the thing broke down, so I never did get a ride in it.
So, what livery was the Comet in when it arrived?
Well, it just, as I recall, it just had the RAF rondelles on it, you know, Royal Air Force.
And was it in Whitehorse long?
No, 2 or 3 days. I think I'm wrong on this now that I think it over again. I think that was, well, if it didn't belong to the Canadian Air Force, it was on loan to them, because I don't know that the Canadian Air Force ever actually bought a Comet, because they had all those problems, you know.
Right. But do you think maybe it was an RAF aircraft? At least it was a military aircraft.
Yeah.
And it was in Whitehorse when you were in government.
Yeah.
Any other unusual aircraft you recollect coming to Whitehorse?
Well, all sorts of aircraft, funny looking aircraft, but there was the big Globemaster came in. That was the U.S. Air Force, and it was a huge 4-engine job. And there was all the different fighters.
When would the Globemaster?
Globemaster. Well, that was during the war. And towards the end of the war, I guess it would be, and they were hauling freight in and out.
Right.
And I think they picked up a couple of aircraft that damaged. And there was a Fairchild C-23, I think it was called. It was a twin engine. Basically, it was built and designed for moving troops and so on in war situations. And there was F-94s and F-89s. F-89 is the Scorpion. That's the first airplane ride I had.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and P-51s and Vampires. Hmm?
Lancaster?
Lancasters and a Lincoln. In fact, there's a Lincoln still in the lake at Watson Lake there.
What would the Lancasters have been doing here?
On an exercise. You know, just come through.
And those would be Canadian or American?
Yeah, no, they'd be Canadian Lancasters. And Lincoln was just a big Lancaster.
Did you ever see a civilian Lancaster?
Yeah, I think so. They were called a Lancastrian.
Mm-hmm.
There was civilian type of Lancaster that they had out of Edmonton. Well, Transcant Airlines had them fly in the ocean after the war.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think I ever saw one up here.
I had heard a story that maybe they'd used a Lancaster for bug spraying.
Not that I know of. Never heard that. We used to have our bug spraying done by the Air Force. It was on a DC-3.
They be putting on town?
What would they be?
What would they be spraying out of the
DC-3? Oh, probably DDT, I suppose, would they?
When did you start to see your private planes around Whitehorse or Yukon?
Well, that would be,
I mean, when you came back from. You mentioned a Cub, I think, even before you left for the Army.
That's right. It was during the war. I don't know how he got gas or anything, but he came up. We were always amazed to see he was going to fly right through the Fairbanks. Of course, there was no road or anything, but he landed, and the airport was being worked on. I remember he landed in the dirt strip at Whitehorse here, and he took on some gas and took off again. We were amazed to see such a little airplane so far away from the bright lights.
And when was the next time?
I don't remember. One that sticks in my mind was Noel Wien brought in his Boeing ADA, and it was one big biplane. It had three engines, and it was, he used it. In fact, I think he eventually brought another one up, but he made a fortune with that, moving stuff just short hops across rivers and so on for the military. And this one came in, and it had the whole side cut out of it, and it had bridge work underneath, reinforce it, and bridge work over the top. Terrible looking thing. And then this big door, so they could get these huge tanks inside.
Tanks?
For oil, I guess, and so on, and storage thing. Three engines, fixed gear, didn't retract. It was a big airplane.
And so it might have been after the war then you were here back with CPA, and were there a few private aircraft around then? Or?
Oh, yeah. There were lots of them starting to come through then.
Any based in Whitehorse?
No, just on the way through. And my partner and I had the refueling business, which was 5 gallon cans, pails. We loaded the pump them in out of 45 gallon barrels and took them out and dumped them through in a funnel, the little guys. And the big airplanes, if they wanted to real load, we'd have to take the barrels out, wobble pump gas into them.
So, just reading a bit, it looked like it was about 1948 that Callison started in Dawson, and he had a Fairchild 24, I guess,
mm-hmm.
EKK, and...
it's in the museum in Evan right now. Kingsway.
And first year there he had a Cessna Crane too, apparently.
Well, later on. He started out with a Fairchild 24, and then he got a Stinson.
Right.
And then...
what kind of Stinson?
A little 150 horsepower Stinson Voyager.
Right.
And we had a Stinson. We had a Stinson station wagon. It had 165 horsepower engine. And his had 150. So when my partner bust ours up, we sold Pat the cockpit forward with the engine, plus our spare engine. And I went down to Dawson and made the conversion from, took his engine out and put in the bigger engine. And then he got a Crane. And then he got, back to, guy killed himself in Calgary with that Crane and went down there. He got liquored up and took off. Night tore up and down between the buildings and finally crashed into a row of houses. And that was the end of it. And then he got an Anson. And when he decided to get rid of that, I flew out with him from here to Edmonton. He picked up a new car and we drove around to Vancouver. Then he got a Beaver. And a 180 when he was in the helicopter deal, and that's what I used to fly when I was with him.
So over to Northern Airways, in the sort of post-war days there, who was flying for Northern Airways?
Herman Peterson, Bob Randall, Les Cook. For Northern Airways?
Yeah, after the war.
Oh, after the war. Oh, after the war. Oh, wow.
Was
Herman Peterson, Pat Collison, the only two pilots.
Sheldon Luck?
Well.
Yeah, I saw an ad suggesting he was a White Horse agent for them or something.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, he did. But he was on the booze at that time, and he came up one day. I was getting the main line out, the Lodestar, in front of the terminal building, and he had an old Fairchild 71 in the hangar and on our side of the airport, and he came up, and I assume he'd been partying the night before, and he had this gal with him, and the airplane, it was in the spring of the year, and this airplane was on wheels, didn't have any brakes, and
71s didn't have brakes.
Well, they did if you set them up that way, but when you were changing over skis to wheels back and forth in the spring, you never bothered putting brakes on them. Mm-hmm. So he parked at an angle in the front of the nose of the Lodestar, and it went into check the weather, I guess, or whatever, he was going to take this girl flying. He came out and the battery was dead, so he got her to sit there and hold the throttle, and he hand cranked it. And I watched all this, and then he rushed around, jumped inside, and he got by the nose of the Lodestar, out the end of the runway at the north end, turned around, opened the throttle, and took off, and he held it down, pulled up like this, and there was a great bang and a cloud of smoke, and he did a split-ass turn and came back, flopped onto the runway. And, of course, the oil that was supposed to be in the engine was in a big bucket in the cabin, and it upset and dumped the oil all through the belly of the airplane, and, of course, seized the engine, packed it up. So George Simmons fired him right off the bat. And so that was his career. When I first met Sheldon Luck, he was flying Lodestars up on the main line.
For
CPA.
How did he come to part with CPA?
Well, the story, as I understand it, is he kept wanting different things and suggesting to McConaughey do this and do that and so on. And he's finally, he always said, if this doesn't done, I'm going to quit or so on. And finally McConaughey said, okay, we accept your resignation. So from there, he went to all different places around the country, around the different parts of the world, actually. He was one of these guys that
had good hands and feet.
Well, up to a point, but they called him the pump handle queen. He'd come in, and this buddy of mine was co-pilot this one trip, and I said, who's your captain? He said, can't you tell? Look at my knuckles are all bruised. I'm sitting there, he was trying to do the logbooks, and Sheldon's coming in, and he's pumping her like mad. However, he was he knew the exact limits that an airplane would go to, and he got away with a lot of stuff that, unless you did have good hands and feet and a pretty good understanding of what you were doing, why you were going to buy it, sure.
So I'm just showing you a couple of ads here, and from the Star, Whiter Star of 1947, and there's a Yukon Airways advertisement saying they've just got a nail contract with Selkirk via CarMax.
I don't know how that is. Well, I guess that was before my time. Because I don't remember them having the contract.
And
well, CPA actually had the contract, and they just sublet it out to us and to them at one time.
And M.A. Cameron there listed under that ad would be G.I. Cameron's wife, Martha Cameron. And then there's another Yukon Airways ad, same sort of thing. And then there's a Whitehorse Flying School ad listing George Mill. And this is, again, October 1947.
I think if my memory serves me correctly, he had a flying school charter to start with.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on he got the flying service charter. He had to go through a lot of rigmarole to get a charter in those days.
And so he lists himself as being a CPA
bush pilot
and proprietor.
He flew for CPA.
So what did he fly for them, or where did he fly?
He was a co-pilot on the, well, actually, I knew him when I was first going out to the airport, going to school, and he was learning to fly. And when I got a job to come up in the White Pass, he says, well, get me a job flying up there and you can be my engineer. And we kind of laugh about that. And by golly, within the year, he came up and flying in 71, and I was riding a bunch of mail and junk in the back, and we were flying to Dawson and Mayo. And we got stuck in Dawson. Weather was so cold that we weren't allowed to fly below 50 below, and it didn't warm up anymore in about 55 or 60, and it'd go down to 65 at night. And we were staying in the old Royal Alec Hotel, and there was not enough rooms. So I was bunked in with a Russian prospector, I guess he was, old Sam Kostov. And they put George in the hallway between the two wings of the hotel. There was a Winnipeg couch, and he slept there. One morning, he got up, and there was a whole batch of kittens in his bed. So he bought a box of cigars and passed them around. Yeah. And then he went out onto the main line, and he was a co-pilot on the Lockheeds. I think these were the Lockheed 14s, the early ones, that they called a Zephyr.
Why a Zephyr?
The what?
Why were they called a Zephyr?
Oh, well, that was just like the Lodestar was called Lodestar.
Okay, and 14 was called a Zephyr.
Yeah. And he was with Ernie Kubicek flying the main line, and Bob Richards, the Richards family, he was worked on the airport maintenance, and they'd been working a long shift, about 10 hours, 12 hours in the wintertime, rolling the airport. And he had a cap and a double roller, connect back, corrugated metal, big ones, pulling them down, and he got the signal from the foreman, Tuffy Sear, to come on in. And by this time, of course, they're sitting there, and they got the covers around on the tarp to get a little heat off the engine, and he dozed off as he's coming by the little round-topped hangar. And he went through the hangar with the cat and climbed up the tail of the Lockheed right up to the Biffy and chewed it all to pieces. Ernie Kubicek came up, he and George Milne came up and said, "What happened to my airplane?" Oh, boy, he was furious. Anyway, but that's he and Lloyd Ryder grew up together, Bob Richards. And after that, they always had a great argument as to who cost the company the most money, Lloyd Ryder by beating up the Boeing 247 or Bob Richards by chewing up the back end of the Lockheed.
So Milne continued flying the main line.
Yeah, and he went to get his instrument rating in south of Edmonton there, where they had a training deal for Vulcan, I guess it was. Anyway, he was taking instrument training, and it was after dinner one night, and he was lying on the bunk in the barracks, and someone went over and they said, "Hey, come on, we're going to a show. There's a show on camp." So George jumped up right away, put his hands up to pick up his jacket off the top bunk, and passed out. And so that was the end of his flying career then. So he...
Because?
Well, he kept... The doctor would say, "Well, look, you know, we can't find a damn thing wrong with you, but until we can... we can't renew your license." So he came to work as a mechanic for Standard Oil up in Whitehorse here. And he worked and saved every dime he could and went out. He even went to Mayo Brothers, went everywhere. And they said, "Well, we can't find a thing wrong with you." So about 2 years or 3 years went by. And finally this one doctor said, "George, the only mistake you made was in going to a doctor in the first place. There's nothing wrong with you." He said, "I can take anybody. And they're sound asleep, and suddenly you wake them up, put their hands above their head, and they'll pass out." So he eventually got his license back, and that's when he decided he got borrowed some money from T.C. Richards and bought the Fleet Canuck, started the little flying school, and then later on I was with CPA maintenance at that time, and he convinced me that maybe we should go into business together.
Okay. So,
that was it. And Airways, we were competing with, but we weren't too concerned because once people did a trip in the CB, that was it. They just didn't want to do it anymore.
And that was the aircraft they had.
Yeah, so we got, like, they were starting to build the Mayo Road, and so they were doing the flying. Well, pretty soon the guys came to us and said, "Look, we don't care for that CB, you fly for it." So we took that business away from them. Pretty soon we really had all the business, and they had none. So George and I were in the position where we were going to have to hire a pilot and some more help and everything. And we thought, well, these guys are going down the tube. So we went to them and said, "Well, okay, let's amalgamate." But there was always strong competition.
And what about Northern Airways?
Well, no, because their aircraft were bigger.
Ah.
Mind you, George, he was kind of fed up with. He calls ours all fart carts. He said, "Nobody wants those." But we were getting the business moving. You know, we'd haul one or two passengers here and there. And over there, you had to take a Fairchild.
A 71,
At 71.
That's a big
one. For a while, well, the Waco, of course, they just rebuilt it completely, stem to stern, and you just starting the engine up to run it up, and the thing caught fire, and they burned it right to the ground. So that was the smallest airplane he had. And that was disappeared, so they had to take the big one. So then he wanted to get out, so we finally said, okay, we'd buy him out. And the idea was he couldn't go back into business for 10 years, which I understand from a legal point of view, of course, wouldn't hold water. You can only restrict a man earning a living for a shorter period of time. However, he wanted out, so we bought the one airplane and all his spares and parts. And then he had to sell the Ansons and the other Fairchilds and so on.
So what about sort of that shift over from, you're shifting from CPA to George Milne. Do you recollect how that came about at all in particular or when it was?
Well, he said to me, he said, how about, you know, would you be interested in coming to work with me and I'll give you a little piece of the action. Mm-hmm. And so I talked it over with my wife and we had a couple of kids by that time. We were living in a company house. And she said, well, you know, suit yourself. Oh, what would you do if you're single? I said, I'd go with him. She said, okay, well, let's go with that. So we went, decided we'd try and take $150 a month apiece if we could, in order to survive. And we went from there.
Do you recollect when it was, or was Harbottle with you guys when he nosed over at Selkirk in 1949?
No.
At Cessna?
No. No, I was still Yukon. Airways.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, so just changing again slightly. So this is a tape number 5 on the interviews with Gordon Cameron on the Yukon Aviation history. And this is May 10th, 2002, and we're in Whitehorse here. So shifting now from Whitehorse Flying Services for a minute over to the RCAF. They, of course, had an establishment here in the post-war years. And did you have much contact with them? Aside from seeing their planes come and go, or
no, not well. We got to know Crosley and Ivy, Pat Ivy, the pilots, a little bit, but we really didn't have anything to do with them. They had their own operation, mm-hmm. And
so do you remember seeing them bring in a helicopter?
The Air Force?
Yeah. One of those yellow S-51s?
Oh, yeah, sure, that was,
And
that was a, that was here for search and rescue.
Right.
And they also had a DC-3.
Right.
And when my partner, George, went missing, it was the S-51 that that was out on the search, and a fellow flying, it was Sam McGee. And he landed. We had gas caches set out, and one at Quiet Lake, and the aircraft search aircraft to land there and refuel. And he came in, landed there, and instead of sitting on the road, which is crowned gravel road, in line of the road, he straddled it crossways, and he came down on his collective and eased off in the power, and the thing slid back into the ditch, and the tail rotor hit the bush and flipped the airplane over. And helicopter over and busted all up and started a fire. Just as I just landed when this happened, and so a bunch of us rushed up and put the fire out. And then they got a that racked that thing up. So then they got a Piasecki, a flying banana, a twin rotor, and that operated here. And I spent a whole day sitting shaking around in that thing, going out to mark the wreckage, George Milne's wreckage, because it has never been marked. And if you don't put a big yellow cross or something on them, people keep reporting the bloody things as missing. So we flew out there, and he darn near lost that. We got into the cirque, and there was a subsiding air, and he had the collective right up under his armpit, and we finally let down on the valley floor, like just below the bowl, and we climbed up a couple of hundred feet up to the wreckage, and then came back that day. But boy, they're a rough airplane, rough helicopter to fly, because you can hardly even read the instrument panel. They're vibrating so much. However, that's the last helicopter they had, the Air Force had in here.
The Piasecki, was that used in the actual searching for Milne?
Oh, no, that was, no, it didn't come up till after the search was all over.
Right.
They had the S-51.
What was the paint scheme on the Piasecki?
It was silver. I think it had black letters, Air Force insignia on it.
You remember the arrival of the S-51? Do you remember when that was? Do you remember any other little prangs that it had? I saw one listed, not much more than that. B grade, as they call it.
The what?
The Air Force has categories of crashes. A is the plane's a rat right off. B,
yeah.
It can't fly and is a bit of a wreck, but they might fix it. They apparently had one in 1952.
Oh, yeah.
Somewhere around Whitehorse. But
yeah.
No.
I don't recall it. No.
So, shifting back now to Whitehorse Flying Services. So, can you talk about some of the particular jobs you might have had with Whitehorse Flying Services? I mean, maybe first before you amalgamated with Yukon Airways. Do you remember any particular contracts? We talked about the topographic survey.
Well, that was after the merger. Yeah,
okay,
well,
the merger. But
no, we just did local charters and had the flying school going and. Finally, we brought in a pilot and his wife, and she was the instructor, ran the flying school, and he was one of our charter pilots. Mm-hmm. That was Ron and Don Connolly, mm-hmm. who was one of the owners of Klondike Helicopters.
Right. And also, they started their own air service, I guess, didn't they?
Yeah. Then they left PWA it was at the time we were operating it, and they went and started up, and they bought Klondike Helicopters in Dodge City and started up their fixed wing, and they went in, got into become Great Northern Airways,
mm-hmm.
and they grew too fast and went belly up.
So you brought in Ron and Don Connolly, and that was before your amalgamation?
No, after.
So you say local charters. So you'd be flying Colin Bairstow out to my fishing camp?
Yeah, Livingston Creek, CarMax, Selkirk, any places like that. In the summer on floats, you'd fly here and there.
Prospectors,
yep.
And
wolf kills, you know, baiting wolves and that sort of stuff.
So that was, for whom would you be doing that?
The game department.
Right.
Yeah. After we amalgamated, we picked up a wolverine in Selkirk. And he had part of a paw ripped off from the trap when he was in this cage behind the pilot seat. He was mad, and I'd turn around and spit at him now and then, and he'd just roar. And
which aircraft were you in?
In a Beaver.
Right.
And we had, at that time, we were doing the mail run for CPA, and we damn near lost the mail contract as a result of this, because they're a member of the Skunk family, you know. And so by the time we got back here, landed, when we first got in, that, oh, geez, the stink, and then you close the doors, and you're flying, and it's fine. As soon as we get down and land and open the door again, we realized what a stink it was. And of course, this thing had urinated in the cage, and it spilled out and ran down the floor into the mailbags. we went down to the post office, threw the mailbags in, and boy, we got a letter, a phone call about an hour later from the postmaster saying, I have a good idea, a good notion to pull your contract for that sort of stuff. We apologized profusely. But, and this thing was going out to Calgary Zoo. And
where were you picking up the mail from, or delivering?
Well,
to?
Dawson. Dawson and not Dawson. I think we picked it up from Selkirk and Carmax, I guess that was it.
Mm-hmm. And was that year-round, or would that be in only sort of breakup?
No, it was year-round at that time, because the boats were pretty well stopped running, you know, mm-hmm. except the one they tried to make it pay off for with CPA for a charter boat.
And why was CPA not doing it themselves?
Well, because they had bigger aircraft. They were just doing Mayo Dawson.
Right.
And the Carmax and Selkirk were, you know, there was, aside from a bit of mail, it was just the odd passenger and so on.
Right. How long, so when you came back from the war, was what aircraft was CPA flying here? Were they doing 71s?
Yeah, doing 71s and on charter, and they have flying Lodestars.
How long did they keep their Fairchild 71s?
A couple of years maybe.
Right. So
they moved them around back and forth over in the Mackenzie district and all that.
Right. So other notable contracts, once you amalgamated with Yukon Airways?
No.
Where was your operating base? Where was the White Horse Flying School?
Right on the White Horse Airport.
Right. What kind of a building did you have?
What kind of what?
Sorry, building?
Oh, well, first we had the old steamboat hangar. And then we moved into the little Yukon Southern hangar, round top one. Now, before we amalgamated, Yukon Air Service had the little round top one, and we had the steamboat.
Mm-hmm. And go ahead.
Yeah, well, that was it. And we got rid of the steamboat.
Why?
Moved out of it. Well, because it was really way too big for our operation anyway. And it was cold. There was the devil. We built a little bit of a place inside the hangar, sort of, where we could heat it. Really. Mm-hmm. And the little round top hangar that Yukon Southern had was more of our size, you know. Mm-hmm. We could put our aircraft in there, because at the time we amalgamated, we had the Super Cruiser and the Ronco sedan and the Fleet Canuck and the station wagon. And Bud, in the meantime, Bud Harbottle had flipped the 140 over in Selkirk, and they'd sold the CB. Oh, and they had a P-12 Super Cruiser.
And so then you had a Super Cruiser and they had one?
No, they had one.
Okay.
And eventually another fellow and I bought it. We had it on floats for a while, too.
Personally?
Yeah.
And that was what era? Sorry, when you bought the Super Cruiser?
Gosh, I can't remember now.
When you were with Pat?
No, before Pat. Before I was with Pat.
And when
I was still with George Milne.
Right. So, what was your? How did you come by, or how did George Milne come by the steamboat hangar?
Well, there was just the two hangars that were available to rent.
Right.
You know, so we rented the steamboat from CPA. It was their hangar,
mm-hmm.
And the boys rented the little round top one, which McConaughey had built for the Lodestar.
Right.
So they were the only two hangars available.
Do you remember what eventually happened to the steamboat hangar?
Well, I don't know what eventually. I know they had a strong wind and it blew all apart one time.
When you guys were renting it, or?
I don't remember whether we were renting it or not. Flipped a couple airplanes over, stored outside. And it blew the doors in on the steamboat hangar on two sides.
Okay.
and the doors fell on top of a staggering beach craft, which was sitting there on floats.
Inside?
Inside. Fell in top
whose
of
beach?
It. Well, eventually became mine. I bought it eventually, but it belonged to an outfit called Tri-Tyro Syndicate. They were prospectors, guys. Eric Nielsen was one of the owners. He was a lawyer. And Bobby Austin.
And what were its registration? What was it?
HSK.
CF, HSK. Hmm? CF, HSK.
HSK, yeah.
And so, sorry, go ahead.
That's it, I think.
And what about float operations? Where would you be facing
your
float operations?
Well, right behind the territorial building there. You know the big gravel bar is out below the bridge? Right at the foot of that. There's a bit of a launch ramp there for boats.
Right.
We were right in there. There's a bit of a back eddy, and that's where we had our dock.
So it's the same basic river bar that was there in 1915.
Oh, yeah. The only thing is, I was saying the other day, before the bridge was in, and a north wind, you could come in, you could land way up, you know, start your approach and come in and touch on one float on the turn and just come around the curve like that, and then drop two floats in and then turn right into our dock.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, once the bridge was there, of course, you had to land way down, turn around, taxi way back upstream.
Mm-hmm. And so you say behind the territorial building, you mean they also
on the riverside, yeah.
Yeah, the sometimes called the YTG building on
yeah,
Second Avenue
yeah,
there.
Yeah.
Second and Hanson, I guess.
That's right.
First. Okay. I think. Difficult strips. So you're operating as Whitehorse Flying Services. Were there particular strips around Yukon that you flew to that you weren't keen to go to because they were?
No, they were. No, they were pretty well any place where there's landing facilities, a lake of decent size. And,
what about, so you said that you got your fixed wing license after training on the, or learning on the Fleet Canuck with George Milne. Was that soon after you joined George, or was that after amalgamation with Yukon Airways?
No, right after I joined George.
Right. And, what about your mechanics license? Somewhere in there you upgraded your mechanics license?
Yeah, I got the overhaul license two or three years later for airframe. And then when I went with Pat Collison, I went down to the helicopter factory at Palo Alto, which was the Hiller factory.
So
took their engineering course there.
So your airframe license, that would have been after you amalgamated?
Well, that was after we sold the outfit. See, after when the outfit was sold to Pacific Western Airlines, and I stayed there for a while, and then I quit that. And I went out on my own. I'd Glacier Aircraft Repair, and I'd salvage aircraft, patch them up, or at least ferry them into Whitehorse, and then some other pilot could take them out to Vancouver if it was a big, major job.
Mm-hmm.
And then Pat Collison came after me.
So you, but when you got your airframe license, was that when you were with Whitehorse Flying Services, or was that
my engineer's license?
Sorry, no, the license, the ticket to allow you to work on airframes. That was
overhaul license.
Yeah. Anyway, it was sometime in the '50s. Anyway, you got your ticket to work on airframes, I guess.
Overhaul
license.
Yeah.